there's going to be increasing and open collaboration between Israeli and Emirati officials. And so even if we get to a point where there's some relaxation of American economic sanctions as a result of new diplomacy between Washington and Tehran, it's unlikely that we'll ever see Dubai revert to its prior position as Iran's central banker and Iran's sort of port to the rest of the world.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 17th, 2020. It was a surprise announcement last week. The United Arab Emirates and Israel are normalizing relations, and Israel is putting on hold its plans for annexation of West Bank territory. We put together a quick All Brookings conversation on the subject and its diverse implications for different actors. Scott Anderson, Lawfare senior editor. Suzanne Maloney, an Iran specialist who is acting head of the foreign policy program at Brookings. Natan Sachs, who runs the Brookings Center for Middle East Policy. And Hattie Ammer, a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings who served as the United States Deputy Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. We covered a lot of ground. What does the deal cover? What are its implications for the domestic politics of Israel, Iran, and the United States? How will it affect the larger regional dynamics, and what does it mean for the Palestinians? It's the Lawfare Podcast, July 17th, a surprise UAE-Israel deal.
All right, Scott, get us started. Give us a high-altitude overview of this surprise announcement yesterday.
Well, sure. Yesterday, President Trump released a statement and came out with an announcement and made some remarks indicating that he, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates, Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, I should say, who is kind of the effective leader of the United Arab Emirates, certainly on diplomatic and national security issues, had reached agreement on the normalization of relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, a fairly notable step in that many Arab states, the majority of Arab states, don't recognize Israel as a state and don't have conventional diplomatic relations of any sort. President Trump kind of introduced this as a groundbreaking development, and certainly is a significant one. I think most would agree. He drew express and explicit comparisons to the Israeli-Jordan peace agreement 25 years ago that laying out that led to a restoration of relations between those two countries and the settlement of a lot of the issues between them and a normalization of relations as well. But perhaps the most notable part of the agreement is that it was contingent upon a suspension of annexation by Israel of territories in the West Bank that had been kind of identified by the Trump peace plan as being somewhat appropriate for annexation or more appropriate perhaps than other parts of the West Bank. The president's statement, and it was confirmed by a joint statement of the three officials that released on the White House website, said essentially, we're suspending that. Annexation isn't going to go forward. Instead, we're going to have this normalization of relations. The durability of that suspension is a little unclear and has been made unclear by subsequent statements. It seems that it's going to be assumed to be at least through the next U.S. election for the foreseeable future, but not necessarily forever. I know that Emirati officials were quoted in interviews today as saying nothing lasts forever when presented with the question of whether annexation was permanently off the table. But that's the basic development as we understand it today.
All right. So, Hattie, for a lot of American viewers, the conversation immediately goes to how big a deal is this for Israel? But I actually want to frame the question in exactly the opposite way. What's in this for the UAE? I look at this and I say the UAE had the kind of perfect arrangement before, which was to say it had exactly as close relations, and on military and security issues, they were very close with the Israelis. And they had, effective deniability on all of it because it was all back channel and a kind of informal, it wasn't exactly denied, but it was sort of deniable. And so they could maintain this posture of having very close relations for all practical purposes without any formal relations at all. And so my question is, what's the advantage of this to them over the relationship that they had yesterday?
Well, Ben, I don't know if this is going to be a satisfactory answer or not, but what I can tell you is that the question that you've just asked yourself is the question that news outlets and ordinary citizens are asking themselves throughout the UAE and the Arabian Peninsula and indeed the Arab world. So, I mean, it is a sincere question that folks are asking themselves, and they're not really coming up with adequate answers. When I've been talking to people from across the Arab world, including in the UAE over the last couple of days, what they've told me, they've essentially asked me that question, you know, why are they doing this? Why is the leadership doing this? What are they getting? And so in a sense, there's a lot of puzzlement that's going on. What I would say is, you know, look, it brings the relationship that was in the closet out of the closet. It does apply significant pressure to Iran and the Iranian axis to say, look, you know, you're not going to be able to guilt us anymore about our relationship with the United States, about our relationship with Israel. We're coming out of the closet on this. And by the way, the implication is that if some other Arab states follow, then I think it's going to put much more of a squeeze on Iran. And if things, you know, kind of normalize in this way and the citizenry of these countries does accept this new relationship, then I think it really does put pressure on Iran in a way that we'll see where it goes. It might contain them or it might lead to, some sort of explosion.
Suzanne, Hadi refers to the pressure this puts on the Iranians. How real is that pressure from the Iranians' point of view? And what do you anticipate the larger kind of regional consequences of a sort of more open Israeli-Gulf relationship to be?
Thanks, Ben. I think it's a really important set of questions. Iran kind of looms in the background around the decision to go public with what has been long known to be an important strategic cooperation between not just the Emirates, but a number of states on the Arab side of the Persian Gulf and Israel, primarily driven by the common threat that they both perceive from Tehran. So for the Iranians, they've, you know, immediately denounced this as a strategic act of idiocy. And I think, you know, we're likely to see more the kind of very heated rhetoric that is intended and has been intended really since 1979 to help the Iranians overcome their own strategic isolation in a region in which they are neither ethnically nor religiously sectarian, in religious sectarian terms, fully accepted within the region itself. They use their support for the Palestinians, primarily rhetorical, but obviously also financial and materiel support to violent rejectionist groups across the region as a kind of wedge issue to help popularize their own position and build their own influence across the region. And so they see these kinds of steps as, if anything, an opportunity from a leadership position. But in reality, I think, you know, the simple act of normalization just reinforces the fact that the Iranians are isolated, that despite their very wide influence and their ability to really dictate outcomes in a number of Arab states, the basic direction of public opinion is not moving in Iran's direction. And in very, I think, concrete terms, what we're likely to see over the long term is an environment where Iran has always had a considerable degree of sway, particularly on economic terms, with the relationship, particularly with Dubai, is going to get a lot more complex because there's going to be increasing and open collaboration between Israeli and Emirati officials. And so even if we get to a point where there's some relaxation of American economic sanctions as a result of new diplomacy between Washington and Tehran, It's unlikely that we'll ever see Dubai revert to its prior position as Iran's central banker and Iran's sort of port to the rest of the world.
Finally, Natan, I want to let's look at it from the Israeli point of view. Obviously, from a symbolic point of view, it is always a big deal when a significant Arab state, or in this case, a very small but nonetheless significant Arab state, normalizes relations with Israel. This is only the third to do so. On the other hand, this is a relationship that has been all but open for quite a long time at this point. How big a deal is this for Israel?
Thanks, Ben, and thanks all. I think it's a big deal. I think cynicism aside, this is no small achievement for Israel and for Netanyahu, too, on a few levels. First, a slight correction, it's the fourth country to sign. If the UAE actually goes through with it and signs something, it's the fourth country. The third there was Lebanon in 1983, where the sectarian government during the Israeli...
Oh, but Lebanon took it back.
Lebanon never even meant it. This would be the third country with relations. That's absolutely true. And it's a very significant one. It's not a country that ever fought Israel, unlike Egypt, of course, or Jordan. But it is a country that offers a lot of potential. It's very small, but it's the banking center of a lot of the region. And it's one that where there really is economic complementarity. So it's true, like the others have said, that the relations have already existed. There's a lot of security cooperation, intelligence cooperation, that I imagine will now continue even more so. But there could also be a lot more economic cooperation now with private individuals from both sides visiting the two countries and doing business. And that can be very meaningful. Dubai, especially, is a center of banking for the region and for much of the world, in fact. And Abu Dhabi has a lot of money. And Israel has quite a bit to offer them as well. So economically, it's very meaningful. Symbolically, it's very meaningful as well. It's not a core country from the conflict perspective. President Trump spoke about a peace agreement. There isn't peace because there actually isn't a state of war between the countries. They never fought. But it is normalization like this with an Arab country, and a very notable one, even if small, as you said, is meaningful symbolically. It would open the door for others to do so. And it's happening at a time when the peace treaty with Jordan, for example, is very weak and under a lot of pressure because of the, I don't know what to call exactly the state of the Israeli-Palestinian relationship, but a peace process that it is not. And it's so much not that really it's called into question many other things, including the Jordanian peace treaty. In that regard, an opening of another country is very meaningful. It also comes with minimal price. It's a suspension of annexation. We don't know for how long, although I think all signs are that it's significantly more than just a few weeks or months. But Israel's not giving back any territory, and it's not facing any likely terrorism or any kind of threat like that.
Yeah, it seems like it's all win for Israel, but I want to probe this a little bit because from the Israeli perspective, the why now question is kind of looms. On the one hand, you had this annexation plan, which had kind of run aground already. And I wonder if it was really the threat of the annexation that, kind of prompts the UAE here to say, we'll go public if you don't go through with it. Is it clear why this is happening now, or is that opaque?
There's some opacity to it. On the face of it, yes, it's about staving off annexation, and so much so that I commented elsewhere that, there's an old Hasidic tale that a man comes to a rabbi, says, "Our house is too crowded." He's a very poor man. The rabbi says, "Bring the goat into the house." And the man is perplexed. And then after a while, says, "Now take the goat out." And suddenly the house seems very spacious. So when you do anything to, just for the sake of doing it, so to be able to pull it back later, that's sometimes called a goat. And annexation seems like a goat now. All this whole story, all this enormous criticism, including by the UAE itself, now seems like just a gambit, basically, to achieve something very meaningful for Israelis, which is this normalization if it actually happens. But why exactly now? Very likely it has to do with the American election and with the perception that perhaps the Trump administration is on the way out. What exactly the Emiratis get, as Hadi was remarking, we don't exactly know. But certainly these are two of the countries with the closest relationships to the American administration, maybe bar none, and especially to Jared Kushner, the son-in-law and the senior advisor to the president, who's had very close relationships with both two countries. The annexation, the way the Palestinians have been referring to it time and again, is as a fig leaf, as a way for the Emiratis to do what they wanted to do, which is open relations with the Israelis on all fronts. And now they say, you see, we're staving off the worst, which would be annexation. Well, in fact, the Palestinians feel, of course, Israel is already doing de facto annexation anyway, and don't do us any favors.
Right. So let's talk about the Palestinians. On the one hand, they have responded with a lot of anger to this. On the other hand, it does stave off the annexation. And so, I wouldn't say they've won exactly, because they obviously don't make any progress in the directions that they've wanted to go. And it's not clear how long this stay of annexation is. But they do get a breather here. So Hadi, what's the logic of the Palestinian reaction to this, and how much of it is sincere anger at the Emiratis, and how much of it is masking a little bit of a sigh of relief?
Look, I haven't seen any sigh of relief on the Palestinian side. And look, I mean, you have to divide also the Palestinian population with the leadership of the Palestinian Authority. But I don't see any masking of relief. I mean, I think that a central pillar of the Palestinian political leadership strategy has been the internationalization of the issue to bring increased leverage on Israel internationally to create a Palestinian freedom and the sort of Israeli domination of Palestinian lives. And so they not only look to the UN and the European Union, but they've, you know, primarily looked to the Arab states. And so, I mean, I think there is a tremendous sense of just betrayal on the Palestinian part, and in the West Bank and Gaza, as well as, you know, those Palestinians who live throughout the Middle East, dare I say, including in the UAE. You know, much of the UAE has been built up by Palestinian ingenuity and entrepreneurship, and there's a great sense of disappointment there. I think the bottom line is, right, I think what the Palestinians are learning is that, you know, their quest for freedom and equality and dignity and prosperity is in their hands. And they, you know, unfortunately, really don't have as many allies as they'd like to have in the region.
And the allies that they do have interests that don't correspond with their own. I mean, I think like one of the big stories here, it seems to me, over the last few years is that the Arab Gulf has looked at Iran and say, yes, yes, the Palestinians and all that, but we have bigger fish to fry. And the Palestinians actually don't have bigger fish to fry than themselves. They're not afraid of the Iranians. And they're kind of the rough equivalent in the United States context of single issue voters, and the Gulf is really not. Is that fair, Suzanne?
I think that's accurate. I think there are other dimensions to this story as well. You know, there is a sort of, I think, vision on the part of at least several Arab leaders in the Gulf about a future that needs to move beyond the past in a lot of different fashions. And so this kind of strict fidelity to the Palestinian issue is one that they have begun to shed. It's also, I think, this new relationship is a recognition that their economic future is not one that's going to be grounded in the past or grounded in their own territory in terms of mineral wealth. You know, they're looking toward a different kind of opportunities, and Israel, with a really vibrant and diverse economy and incredible depth of technology, is going to be a very natural destination, I think, for possible investment and trade opportunities. But I think what's so interesting about the way that at least several political figures from the Emirates have been describing what this means is that they haven't really been putting Iran front and center, you know, which is not to say that Iran isn't relevant, but at least one, Anwar Gargash, the Minister of State of Foreign Affairs for the Emirates, pitched this move as essentially a bid to save the two-state solution. I think that that's an important element of the thinking here, how much it actually serves that purpose. Others on this call are better positioned to say. But I think it will be certainly interesting to watch to see how resonant that is with other leaderships, with others around the region. Iranians, of course, are counting on it not, but they're also quite nervous. I think with some of the rhetoric we've seen out of Tehran seems to be very much directed at trying to warn off other countries in the Gulf from following suit and signing similar declarations, or at least becoming more open in their cooperation with the Israelis. So we really are seeing, I think, a historic shift, and we won't really know what it means and how it plays out immediately.
Right. So Suzanne refers to, I think, one of the several elephants in the room, which is this the thin edge of a larger wedge? The wedge being what the UAE does today, does Saudi Arabia do tomorrow? And so I'm not sure which of you has thoughts on this, but I'll throw it open to the group. You know, is this, I don't know, it seems weird to say the camel's nose under the tent when you're talking about the Arabian Peninsula. It's what I would say if we were talking about a different part of the world. So I guess I will say it, even though it seems a little bit peculiar. I mean, is this the dam breaking, and you get the UAE today, and then the Saudis, who have a similarly, I guess, less close, but also undenied kind of intelligence and security relationship with the Israelis, that, you know, that becomes a very big deal if that happens. So how much are we expecting this to be isolated, and how much of this is a harbinger of a different kind of relationship between Israel and the Arab Gulf?
I would say it's a combination of both. There's, on the one hand, this could really open up a lot of things, in particular because, as I said, I think the UAE, certainly on the economic, banking, financial levels, is a gateway to a lot of things. And we may see some small Gulf states follow suit. There's already some signs. The Omani foreign ministry spoke favorably of this deal, which is very notable in the Arab world. And there's been talk about the Bahrainis doing it. That, of course, depends on what Riyadh tells them they might do. Riyadh would be harder to do. And part of the reason is that we're talking about very small states with very small populations. And in the Middle East, this new dynamic where Israel is more kosher and Iran is the boogeyman, although not the only one, is very characteristic of the leadership. But among the publics, we still see the Palestinian issue as emotive. It's not nearly as emotive as it used to be, but it could be again. If there were another conflict in Gaza or another intifada or something surrounding Jerusalem in particular, you could easily see publics throughout the Arab world galvanized again around this issue. So a small country with a very small population and a ton of wealth is the natural one to be able to buck the sort of public opinion trend. It also happens to be the one that's most modern in some ways. More traditional countries would have a harder time. A lot of that does not apply to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has a sizable population. It's a big country in many ways. And that is a very different scenario. It's not impossible. The crown prince is certainly a maverick, but he's not alone. He has a father, and there are others. I just add one more thing, which is, the common interests are not just Iran. There's another sort of other that both Israel and especially the Emiratis fear, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood and the sort of Muslim Brotherhood aligned axis, in particular of Turkey and Qatar. And those two countries in particular, Qatar with a very deep hostility between the UAE and Qatar, but the Turks as well, with a lot more activity in the Arab world recently, that's a camp that both the Israelis and especially the Emiratis fear and are quite hostile to. And so there's really an elective affinity here on many levels between these two countries.
Scott?
Yeah, I agree entirely with what Natan just said. The only thing I would add is that in my mind, I think this is much more of a lagging indicator than it is of a sort of breakthrough moment that the Egypt or Jordan peace deals were. Each of those were cases where you really saw a massive amount of obstacles between a normalization of relations that were able to work through pretty diligent diplomacy. In this case, again, we've already seen the de facto relationship between these two states and the de facto relationship between Israel and a number of other Gulf states drifting in this direction for a while. And it is part of the broader trend I think several of us have talked about on this podcast before, which is that the Palestine issue is just not the driver in the region that it was 40 years ago, and that Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood concerns, related concerns, are kind of the new drivers for a lot of regional relationships, in part being driven by the Gulf and to some extent Israel as well, and their unique kind of concerns. So I think you are likely to see a drift in this direction. Oman and Bahrain seem like likely candidates for the reasons Natan notes, also just because, you know, Oman has always had a more independent foreign policy. Bahrain, I think, is in more in the UAE camp, and maybe if Saudi Arabia does give the go-ahead, willing to take this step, doesn't have to worry about as much the kind of popular opposition as maybe some other states do. It may not go much further beyond that in the short term necessarily. But again, I think you are already seeing a drift in this direction substantially. I'm not sure that this is to use another poor metaphor, the straw that broke the camel's back. Instead, I think this is, one of these indicators of a trend that's already in place, and that if anything was probably delayed by the discussion of annexation and the rhetoric around that point, as we've heard out of the United States and Israel for the last few months. Indeed, we saw the Emirati ambassador to the United States basically make this case publicly in June of this past year, basically saying, look, Israel is going to have to decide between normalization and annexation. And normalization, which we're on track to do, could get derailed by annexation. And it sounds like that message was received. And that's kind of what may have been driving this sort of decision point ultimately to opt for normalization over annexation.
Just to strengthen what Scott is saying, that op-ed was in Hebrew, by the way, in an Israeli newspaper.
Good point. Yeah.
That's pretty interesting. So, Natan, I want to ask you about the Israeli domestic politics of this, because this comes at a time in which the Israeli government is teetering on collapse only a couple of months after it was established. There are large protests outside the prime minister's house every night that are somewhat more diverse than the usual coalition against him. And all of a sudden, he pulls an incredible rabbit out of the hat, normalization with the UAE. How much of this is about the nine lives of Bibi Netanyahu, and what is the likely consequence in Israeli domestic politics?
That's two excellent questions. The answers are quite different. So how much of this is about Netanyahu's nine lives? A lot of it is about his nine lives. A lot of what's been happening in Israel for the last year and a half, and in some ways even more, is about one individual. That's obviously not a healthy state for any democracy to be in. Netanyahu formed a government recently, and now he's contemplating breaking it up. It's teetering, but that's the passive tense. He is teetering it. He is simply calculating whether or not he wants elections before his trial is set to enter its main stage in January, when the evidence will be presented, etc. A lot of this is about the legal calendar of one individual, Benjamin Netanyahu. It's not why he's doing this with the UAE. Almost any Israeli an Israeli leader would do this very gladly, but the annexation, the fact that there have been three elections in the past year and a bit, the fact that there might be a fourth election, all this has to do with Israeli elections and with his fate in particular. It also, of course, has to do with the American elections, and we really shouldn't underestimate the factor, the variable of Donald Trump. A lot of all this has to do with a sense among the Israeli leadership that the tenure of Donald Trump is this historic opportunity that may never return, where you have a maverick president, to say the least, who's not only willing to break with norms, but almost eager to do so, and who has decided for whatever reason that he is in favor of almost every position that Israel has ever taken, and then some. So pushing Israel to do things that it has not requested to do or didn't think of doing earlier, for example, annexation. This is meaningful, I think it's important to raise also because Netanyahu, when he raised the annexation issue, it came in a campaign and he was trying to shore up support on the right. There was probably, I think, also legacy issues. I do believe he meant it, at least at one point. It doesn't mean he always meant it, but I do think he meant it at one point. But by not doing it now for normalization with the UAE, he is also sending a strong signal to the far right in Israel, which is even with the President Trump, even with this big green light from David Friedman, although probably not from Jared Kushner at the moment, still annexation is not happening. That's an important signal. It's not hugely positive, but it is positive to my mind. It doesn't mean that other things won't continue. They will. But it does mean that this de jure annexation won't happen even on these favorable terms when everyone is thinking about November and then January and the possibility that, Joe Biden may win. This, again, Netanyahu coming back full circle. Netanyahu is looking at that and thinking, do I want to face elections after there is a less favorable administration to him, Netanyahu, in the White House, and when his trial is full-blown? Or do I prefer to go to elections now when the opposition is completely splintered, again, by him, not passive tense, but splintered by Netanyahu, and may perhaps now with this achievement? It's not an easy calculation. I'll just end by saying a lot is sort of good for Netanyahu in that regard and points towards another election now. There are three downsides. One is these demonstrations that you mentioned, and they come, of course, on the backdrop of the coronavirus and, a serious uptick in the pandemic in Israel, which has brought out people to the streets, including Likudniks and right-wingers who are simply hurting and are very angry at the government for mishandling a second wave. And secondly, of course, the legal issues. The simple issue that Netanyahu is about to go on trial in a very visible way is driving a lot of what's happening in Israel.
And so what's your prediction? Do we end up with elections this fall in Israel, or does Netanyahu tough it out and keep this coalition together while he ends up dealing with the coronavirus and, then facing trial?
Predictions are for fools. So the short answer is I have no idea. And I have no idea in particular in this case because it really depends on the calculations of one man. And that's extremely difficult to predict. There would be good reasons for him to do so. The opposition is shattered and he would be facing a harder time when his trial ramps up and if Joe Biden wins. However, Israelis don't want a fourth election. That's overwhelmingly true. It's true of Likudniks as well. And Netanyahu is prime minister now. He's not an interim prime minister. He has a coalition. It would be quite clear that he's the one who broke it up. The excuse is flimsy. It's about passing a one-year budget instead of a two-year budget, and it's preposterous. There's no the one-year budget he wants to pass is just till the end of 2020. So there's good reason for him to fear it. But with what he chooses in the end, I don't know. It depends on how much he thinks this also helps him. My guess is that this certainly helps him, I think in my mind too. It helps him very much in terms of legacy, but it does not alter fundamentally an understanding of Israelis of Netanyahu himself. He was already seen as a master diplomat, at least in this world, with Donald Trump as president, and is certainly the more experienced and able statesman. But it does not change other perceptions of him on the corruption side and especially on the dealing with the coronavirus and the attendant economic crisis. Those are things that many Israelis might be sick of. Could he go to elections? Absolutely. Would the result be very different? Probably not. And he would then have to calculate, is it worth the risk, which does exist?
All right. So, Hadi, we were talking about the Israeli domestic side. Let's talk about the U.S. domestic side. This election is not going to be decided in any material sense based on the Israeli-UAE relationship in the United States. On the other hand, it was important enough for the Trump administration to kind of announce on its own and to, as best as I could tell, preempt the announcement by the parties. They seem very proud of it. They seem to think it works for them. What is their calculation about this? And to what extent is that calculation realistic, or are they kidding themselves that anybody in the United States really cares what Israeli-UAE relations look like?
Okay, I think you're right. I mean, I think that is such a minute issue off a minute issue. That said, right, I think the timing, you know, announcing this in mid-August, with a, you know, a signing ceremony and pomp and circumstance in September. I think it certainly makes Trump look presidential. And look, I mean, I think there is a segment of both the Arab American, American Muslim, and the Jewish communities, right, who focus on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, who focus on the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. And so for those voters, right, this could be enough for some of those voters, for some small portion of those voters, this could be an issue that maybe tips the balance, right? And as we saw in the last election, where just, you know, thousands of votes in a few key states tipped the election, it could make a difference for this subsegment of these subsegments. And these are not small populations. You know, there are hundreds of thousands of Arab American and American Muslim voters in key swing states like Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan. I mean, elsewhere, of course, New York and California, but they don't matter so much in the presidential election, you know, as well as Florida. And then there are significant, you know, populations of American Jewish voters in Florida. And look, I think for the most part, most of these voters are going to stay right where they are, you know, focusing on domestic policy, focusing on the general state, focusing on the coronavirus, focusing on the economy. But there will be some small portion of them that are focused in on this, and maybe tips them over, and that's a difference in the election. I mean, I can't help but look at the timing and think that there's, at minimum, that Trump's team saw this as a benefit.
So I agree with you that they saw it as a benefit. They wouldn't have played it the way they played it if they didn't. But I'm a little bewildered about why they think it's a benefit. So let's take the Michigan Arab and Muslim American populations as probably the most pivotal. You know, I agree with you. There's a significant population in Pennsylvania, but I do think the density of the population in Michigan is pretty substantial. And certainly that was the closest of the swing states. So, you know, here you have a candidate who comes into office with a travel ban. He's flirted with white nationalism on many occasions. His hostility to Islam is pretty open. And while you can frame this as an agreement between Arabs and Israelis, which both Arabs and Israelis might like, as you pointed out before, a lot of Palestinians feel very betrayed by it. And to the extent there's a political center of gravity of a community like on foreign policy issues like the Michigan community, it's highly conditioned by the Palestinian questions, not by Gulf Israeli questions, which aren't going to move a whole lot of people. So my question is, like, why do they think this plays well for them rather than playing in Michigan like the Trump administration brokered the UAE sellout of the Palestinians?
Look, I think you've got it right. Like I said, I think they think it helps shore up their vote with the evangelical base. I think, you know, having worked on so many presidential campaigns, I think, you know, there is a, you know, sense that conservative Jewish voters in Florida matter. And I think you've got it pretty much right. There's also been an undervaluing of the Arab American and American Muslim vote, where the Palestinian voice has resonance in Michigan. But I really want to add, right, I mean, we've been looking at the numbers that have been developed over the last couple of years. There really are hundreds of thousands in each of these states, Michigan, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, Virginia, of Arab American and American Muslim voters. And I, on the one hand, you're right, right? What is it going to take? You'd think they would be voting, you know, clearly against Donald Trump. On the other hand, a lot of these voters had their hearts set on Bernie Sanders, and, you know, they're not as excited about Joe Biden. And so it just kind of takes something to convince them. But you're right. In terms of Donald Trump, I mean, I think it may not help them in the end, but they just think it does. Because that they're looking at, I think, votes in certain communities.
Yeah, I think they're they're overvaluing how it plays in the Jewish community, which, you know, also doesn't have that fluid a partisan movement. I mean, Trump will not get more than 30% or so of the Jewish vote, but he's overvaluing the way it plays in the Jewish community, you know, and extrapolating that to how it plays. And I just think that that's not obviously correct.
I was just going to jump in, not to try to dissect the constituencies to which the Trump administration may be trying to appeal, but to sort of link this to the broader narrative that I think the president probably would be very happy to return to if he could, which is to say, if you remember where we were, oh, now about 8 months ago, the major issue of the day was the successful U.S. strike that killed the leader of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, Qasem Soleimani. And I think that Trump and the administration really expected that they were going to be able to campaign around having done something historic, having taken out a key terrorist leader, and really demonstrating why a muscular U.S. foreign policy was the right approach. And that, in fact, probably would have played well with the base. You've seen a little bit of this even still in while the president was able to do public rallies. When he talked about this, the auditoriums lit up with applause. And so I think, you know, to the extent to which he can depict this act as part of a broader effort of American muscular strategy really paying off in a way that has protected American allies like Israel, has advanced the cause of peace, as, you know, by not, you know, sort of sticking to some of the old constraints that prior American political figures might have felt compelled to abide by, that the Trump administration has achieved some breakthroughs. I have no idea, and I can't imagine that it would actually sell in a electorally significant way in the time of coronavirus, but I can see why this sort of a narrative would be appealing to the president, especially in the time of coronavirus.
That's so interesting. I mean, you just made about the best case for it as that I've heard, you know, and I suppose you could link that to the Baghdadi killing as well, right? And you could say by thinking out of the box and being, you know, aggressive on things that other people thought were impossible, everybody said we were going to blow up the region. And in fact, that hasn't happened. And in what has happened instead is the natural alliances of the Gulf states and Israel have begun to come into their own in public. I mean, it's an interesting case. It would be curious to see if they can make it coherently.
I think it may be even a little more lowest common denominator than what Suzanne's carved out there, although I don't disagree with what she said. The president right now, his biggest vulnerability is the basic question of competence as president, particularly around the COVID crisis. But really, at this point, it's reaching into all elements of his presidency. And this is a case where this is the president, by all appearances, accomplishing something that almost everyone agrees is a good thing and is something that the United States has talked about for decades. And I think the fact that in his remarks, President Trump tied this back again to the Jordan-Israel deal 25 years ago, those really, you know, famous pictures of Rabin and Hussein at the White House with Clinton hashing out these issues, reaching this monumental agreement. I think this is his effort to say, I have some accomplishments I can point to so that I can actually be an effective president. I think it's probably also the reason we see Ambassador Grinnell kicking and screaming to pull Kosovo and Serbia together in early September for another talk that may produce yet another largely symbolic, but nonetheless significant diplomatic accomplishment. We know the president has had some success with certain diplomatic accomplishments in the past around, you know, North Korea and certain other issues, some of the Israeli issues as well, that are controversial in many circles, but nonetheless give him that sort of air of at least some people saying this is the moment where he became presidential. And he may be trying to recapture a little bit of that in light of the challenge to his basic competency as president that the coronavirus challenge has posed.
We are going to leave it there. Scott Anderson, Natan Sachs, Hadi Amar, Suzanne Maloney, thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and this episode is a super good illustration of what that means. Our audio engineer this episode was Zachary Frank, the only non-Brookings person associated with this podcast other than Jen Patya Howell, who is our producer and editor. All the guests are Brookings people. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast and, for that matter, the Brookings Institution. Tweet about it. Share it on Facebook. Upvote it on Reddit and pin it on Pinterest. Make TikTok videos about it and post an Instagram photo of yourself listening to the Lawfare Podcast. You can get our merch at thelawfarestore.com. Our music is performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan, who I guess doesn't have a Brookings affiliation either. And as always, thanks for listening.